Okay, everyone, welcome to the Choosify Radio podcast. Today on the show, we're bringing on Robert, the college investor, and this is a granular look at multiple paths to financial independence through the eyes of someone that absolutely does not claim the mantle of frugality. I think it is going to be a wonderful, wonderful, actionable episode, and I can't wait to hop into this. Welcome to the Choosify Radio podcast.
You're listening to Choosify Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
Okay, let's hop into this. I do not want to steal any of Robert's thunder. I think you are going to get an incredible value out of this episode. We are going to be talking about his path to a six-figure income in retail and how you can too, which is incredibly powerful in and of itself, and how simultaneously he built a small side hustle, a small blog, which has since become one of the largest millennial finance blogs on the internet today. Incredibly fascinated and excited about this story. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Yeah, I'm doing great, Jonathan. I'm really looking forward to this episode with Robert. It seems like it should have a little bit of everything, right? It's got the fully funded lifestyle change story. It has business building. It has student loans and millennial finance. And also, Robert's just a really interesting guy. I've been following his blog for a number of years. And yeah, it was neat to see him show up in our Facebook group and be such an active member. So yeah, it's neat that he's part of the FI community. And with that, Robert, welcome to the show.
Hey guys, thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Robert, with you in particular, I really want to go origin story here. Like, I love the idea of finding out, you know, what were these series of decisions, these small moments in time that you took action on that kind of led us to where we are now having this particular conversation. Tell us a little bit about yourself. And in particular, were you always interested in pursuing different types of side hustles and ventures? Or was this something that you just stumbled on in your 30s?
So I am 33 years old, and I do describe myself as a side hustler forever. I don't have a big life-changing event that's led me to this path. It's definitely been a series of little small choices and events that have just built up over time. I'm a big earning more money kind of guy. You won't find me talking a ton about frugality and cutting on my grocery expenses, but I am all about hustling and side hustling. And one of the first things that always stands out to me is when I was in middle school, I used to go with my mom to Costco, right? And at Costco, they have those like 24-pack candy bars, and I would buy those at Costco, and then I would go and take them in my backpack. And at break and lunch in middle school, I would sell those candy bars for like 50 cents, 75 cents a pop. But I would like double my money versus the whole pack every single time. And then the next week I'd go back to Costco and I'd have a nice little profit. I'd buy another box and I would repeat the process again until I think I got shut down by like one of the vice principals after like a couple of months of doing it.
Scaling is always the issue.
Right?
That's fantastic. I feel like you're maybe the third guest who's talked about some kind of interesting middle school entrepreneurship. And I'd love to almost be a sociologist and like follow different middle schools and find that one or two boys or girls who have those little side hustles and see where they end up and how many of them are millionaires, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's just when people ask me like, what's my hobby? My hobby really is making money. I love to just find little random ways that I could earn some extra income, because then I feel like not only am I spending my time doing something I enjoy, but you get that monetary reward from doing it.
Yeah, this is really interesting. So what you're talking about is almost the gamification. And I'll be honest with you, in the same period that you were kind of getting this gamification hit from, you know, essentially earning money from building small businesses, I was just getting it from video games. In retrospect, where I am now, that no longer holds the appeal for me. And in fact, I went into a video game store recently just to kind of see what am I missing out on, and kind of went out just kind of bored, because building businesses can be very fun. You can put all of your energy into that. And the cool part is you know, instead of tracking your high score in a video game, now you start focusing that same energy on growing this little side hustle or this business. And now you're tracking, how can I scale it? How can I grow it? You know, month over month, year over year. It just kind of takes that gamification element and applies it to something that you're passionate about, like a side hustle. I find that very compelling.
See, I'm totally with you here. Like, I would say my one recreational thing is playing video games. But you know what video games I really enjoy playing are ones that you build. Like, I like Civilization or SimCity or Roller Coaster Tycoon, where I'm actually building a business. So it's kind of ironic. We're just talking about that.
All right. So, Robert, I'm curious about this candy bar selling business. So where does this come from? Did you just decide one day, hey, I can make a business out of this? Do you even remember where that came from? And did your love of business and or maybe just money, plain and simple, like did it predate this or did it just come up when you decided, hey, I can do this?
It was actually probably driven by my parents, maybe intentionally or unintentionally. You know, they were very much of, you don't get any spending money. You get a little bit of allowance. And if you want to go like video games or I used to have Blockbuster at that time, right? So I wanted to rent a video game and they weren't coming up with any cash for that. So if I wanted to, like, I needed to find ways to do it. And they would offer me things like, well, you could mow the yard or, you know, trim some hedges in the back. And, you know, like this manual labor out there really didn't appeal to me. So I think it was just like a confluence of wants and what I didn't want to do and kind of getting creative about ways to earn.
Yeah, it's funny thinking back to these formative moments. I remember, and I don't know where this thought came through my mind when I was a kid. I remember a good buddy of mine mowed lawns and this one woman paid him by the hour. And I remember saying as a 14-year-old kid, are you crazy? That's the opposite incentive that you want. You want to finish it quickly and like be efficient. And I mean, no joke, like this is not revisionist history. Those were the words coming out of my mouth at 14. It would be so interesting to be able to go back and put ourselves in those shoes again and really try to figure this out. Where did this come from? Did our parents instill this in us when we were young? Is it just innate? I really just don't know.
Brad, how did you even, my mind is blown right now. I didn't realize this, but we got to highlight this. You are placing a value on your time and separating your time for money at the age of, I mean, what are we talking about? Is this 14?
I don't know where that came from, Jonathan. I just had this sense that this is a job. This is a finite, discrete job. Why should you be paid for the hour? It's so inefficient. It's, what are you paying me for? You're paying me to complete this job. Why do you care how quickly I do it? That stuck with me throughout my entire life. Why do we have to work from 9 to 5 if you can get the job done from 9 to 2, right? So it's kind of funny.
You know, what's funny is I thought you were going to tell me this story was going to go to, it took him 2 hours to mow the lawn now, because if I was getting paid by the hour to mow someone's lawn, I would go very slowly to get extra money for doing the project.
Yeah, the math is incredibly simple when you take a real hard look at it. But I mean, we all at some point, I mean, most of us, you know, once you get that first job, in some way, shape, or form, are working for some form of an hourly wage. I mean, what was your first job?
My first legit, I guess, real job for, you know, a W-2 is I was working at Target. I was a cart boy. I was a cashier. I worked on the sales floor. And I started that when I was 16 years old. Once again, this is really my parents doing. My mom bought me a 1996 Dodge Dakota for like $2,000. It had like a dent in the door. The door barely closed. But I was stoked. I was 16 years old. And she's like, you're so happy you got this car. I was like, yes, I love it. She's like, well, that's great. But you better get a job if you want gas and insurance and everything else that comes with it. And she drove me to the mall, said, call me back to pick you up when you have a job. I applied at Starbucks. I applied at like a couple other mall stores. And then I made my way down the mall to Target. I applied there and I got a job there. And that actually is how 17 years of my life progressed. But I started at 16 years old.
Wow. So you started at 16 at Target. And yep. I see just from your online profile that you obviously went to college and I think got either an MBA or a master's. So did you work at Target throughout college as well?
I did. I worked literally from 16 until about a year ago at Target and worked my way up.
Wow. That's amazing. I've never heard of that. I don't know that I know of anybody, right, who started a job in high school and stayed until their 30s. That's really neat. Is that common at Target to promote from within and have this kind of continuity?
It comes and goes with the tide, but there's actually a lot of people that have done it. I actually really like Target. I think it goes both ways. I think they're actually a really great company to work for, and I love my time there. I would never have stayed that long if I didn't. And at the same time, they really do give you a lot of skills and promote you up, and I enjoyed it. I love my time there. I found it to be a relatively easy job. It's retail, so you still have nights, weekends, and holidays, which are like the big derailers, which eventually were outweighed by my side incomes and stuff. But yeah, I mean, I loved it. It was great.
So obviously you educate millennials and people on college and student loan debt and such, and you went to college, but yet yes, you stayed at your same company, basically, I guess, throughout and after. Talk me through how that works. Like, okay, I came out with a bachelor's and I came out with a master's degree. Like, what happens at your actual day job at Target after that goes down?
When I went to college, I got promoted from like an hourly person to a supervisor. So I was working full time, 32 to 40 hours a week, all through college as an hourly supervisor. I went to UCSD right here in San Diego and I got my bachelor's degree, but I was working 40 hours a week. I think in my peak, I was making about $18 an hour. So I was feeling pretty good, you know, just an hourly supervisor working. And then when I graduated college, I promoted up to like an assistant store manager. And I think I was making $43,000, maybe $46,000 a year, my first year out of getting my bachelor's. And the cool thing is Target has a lot of programs to support and help out. They had a tuition reimbursement program that supported a little bit of my undergraduate degree. And then they had the tuition reimbursement program also supported my master's degree. So I still had to take out student loans, and I had, you know, $44,000 in student loan debt by the time I was done with all 6 years, I guess you can say, with my bachelor's and my master's. But Target did pitch in a lot and help me cover a lot of those costs.
This could be called the Target Path to Fi, Brad.
Yeah. No. But I mean, actionable takeaway, Robert. Tuition reimbursement program. How does that work? And do you advise people on your site to look into that at their own companies?
Absolutely. So how it works is, and every company has a different setup. And so my problem with Target would reimburse you for business classes that you take. And they don't even have to be going towards a degree. Like, you could go to a community college or a vocational school, but as long as you take something in their broad definition of a business class, they would reimburse you for the cost of the class. I think they would reimburse you for undergraduate vocational up to like $1,800 a year. And then for your master's degrees or advanced degrees up to $5,250 a year. And so my problem was, I was a political science major, so not all my classes counted. And even if I tried to write the description like this would somehow count, I was getting some approved, but they wouldn't approve at all. But I was able to get some money to pay for my undergraduate. And then they did reimburse me a large portion of my master's degree as I was going through that.
And so that's a grant. That's not something you ever have to pay back. That's just, hey, we're giving you free money.
Yeah, so you get it after the fact. So you got to pay up front, you complete the class, you pass the class, and then they would reimburse you up to the limit for that amount. And there are a lot of companies that do that tuition reimbursement. So it's a great way to get an education and minimize some of those costs.
You know what I actually like about highlighting Target specifically, and you could insert another company name here, but I do like the fact that this is a granular look at what it would look like to reach FI in a very, very specific, you know, sector of the economy, and that's retail. And there are a lot of these types of employers. I'm curious, you know, because you just said you left your job within the last several years. I don't want to go to that yet. I want to put you back in this situation. And as you're looking at this as someone who did it and someone who's now looking back on it, not inside the machine anymore, is this a viable model to reach an above median income job? And could you have hit FI on this career path alone? What did it look like for you? And what could you have done better looking back?
Absolutely. So I could tell you that I would have hit FI in my, I technically did hit FI with my retail job and side hustling at the same time, because I'm only out of, you know, my retail job for 9 months at this point in time. If I did not side hustle at all and I just kept with Target, I think I probably could have hit FI by roughly 40 on the career path I was on. It's very doable. I think a lot of people don't realize that, you know, being a retail assistant manager is a really good paying job for your first job out of college. And being a retail store manager is an incredibly lucrative job. I would tell you that with my salary and my bonus, I was making $180,000 a year at Target. Now, I think a lot of people might be very shocked by that, but I was pretty average as a store manager. My performance wasn't, but like in terms of my pay, I was pretty average.
Wow. So $180,000 a year. Is that at all because you were in a high cost of living area, or is that what a store manager would be paid anywhere in America?
It's, you know, pretty common that that's what they're paid. I mean, you might shave off 10,000 here, 20,000 here, if you're going to a lower cost of living area. And if you go to a higher cost of living area, you'll earn even more. I know in the Bay Area and in New York City, the hourly supervisors where I was in college at $18 an hour, they're making about $30 to $35 an hour as an hourly manager or a supervisor.
Wow. I'm picturing this as a very viable path to FI. Maybe even potentially before 40 for someone, if you're going to make 160K a year as a store manager in a very low cost of living area. I mean, that's an incredible figure.
Yeah. And the cool thing is it is more flexible than I think a lot of people realize. So yes, you do work nights and weekends. You have the holiday season, which, you know, can really be a downer. But short of Black Friday to Christmas and everything else, I get a day off in the week because I work the weekends. And for someone that likes to get things done, that is amazing. There are a lot of great things that people don't realize about working in retail.
Let's go really granular with this. So going to college, picking a poli sci degree, like that wasn't based around, you know, necessarily becoming a store manager at Target, I would imagine. At some point, maybe your vision crystallized, but let's put yourself in this situation. You have a very large audience listening to this and they're thinking, holy crap, that sounds doable. And maybe they have a child or maybe it's them that's thinking, how can I do this even faster or better than what Robert did? What would the path look like if you were going to streamline this from cart boy to store manager, 160K a year, and you want to compress all this down into your 10 to 15, you know, year career plan?
Yeah, I mean, it all comes down to your skill set. So the big thing with retail leadership is it's probably one of the few careers that is really 100% people leadership. So to be the most successful, you have to be a good people leader because you are leading large teams, you're interacting with customers, and all this requires a very different skill set than, say, engineering or, you know, finance. If you're a great people leader, you can really work your way through being a leader at Target or another retailer. That's really what it takes.
Was the college degree a big piece of this puzzle?
Yes and no. It's one of those things that it's the paper that shows that you care. Did it actually give me any skills to be successful? I don't think so. I think the skills that allowed me to be successful was side hustling from middle school, getting to know how people interact, and starting working at 16 and understanding the dynamics of customer service and how the environment works and that type of thing.
So Robert, as far as that piece of paper that signifies something, obviously UCSD is a very good school. What if you went anywhere? Did it really matter, or was it just, hey, I have a 4-year degree? Like, did that actually aid in you getting the store manager's position?
Yes and no. It aided me to get the assistant store manager position because Target is still hung up. I would say that 70 to 80% of people getting into that assistant store manager role, you know, it's one of those things, they don't require a 4-year degree, but they say a 4-year degree required or experience, but they kind of like cut out the second half of the sentence there for most people. So it really does help you get to that assistant store managership in good time. And that's where you can actually start making, you know, when you're 22 years old, I think they're paying like $55,000 a year or so for 22-year-olds when they graduate college and their first job after college.
I'm sorry to keep drilling down on this, but this is really interesting. And I think this is applicable to so many companies, obviously, or we wouldn't be spending so much time on it. But does it matter if that degree is from the University of Phoenix or UCSD or Harvard or a 2-year community college into a state school? Is it literally just, hey, I have a 4-year bachelor's?
Or yes, it's literally just, I have a 4-year bachelor's. So some of my staff that used to work for me there were going to like the University of Phoenix's and stuff and working at Target, raising a family, and then taking classes on the side to try to get there. And they got there as soon as they got their degree. You know, even though they could have probably done the job already, it really launched a little bit of a fire under getting them promoted.
Robert, that's really, really helpful information that, yeah, this really is in many cases, or at least in Target and probably many similar companies, just to check the box. So therefore, the actionable takeaway is try to do this as inexpensively as possible and don't worry about the name brand school necessarily if this is your path.
Absolutely. And this is, I see this every day at the College Investor, what people get themselves into when they're paying for school to get a degree. The degree is only valuable for maybe the first 18 months after you graduate. After that, the only thing that employers will ever care about is your experience. So if you're already 24 and you've been out of college 2 years, your degree doesn't matter in the least. Employers want to know your experience and what value you bring to them. And with that being said, the biggest problem I see today is what I like to call the overeducated and underexperienced, because so many young adults start going right into a master's degree or an advanced degree program. They take on more student loan debt, and they end up still having to get the entry-level job that doesn't pay them enough to afford all the debt and everything else they've took on. And they've really just dug themselves into a hole that does put them 10 years behind someone that didn't get overeducated and underexperienced. So my big takeaway here, I guess I'd say, is line up your education with your experience. That's the best way to maximize the value of your education and increase your return on investment of your education spending.
Overeducated, underexperienced. That is the most powerful, mind-blowing phrase that I've heard. And it sums up that lost decade that we keep describing. What is happening for that decade between your 20s and your 30s? Why are we talking about starting at 32? That's crazy talk, right, Brad?
Yeah, it is. And that's funny. I just jotted down overeducated and underexperienced is a financial death spiral. That's how I would look at that. There's almost no way out of that.
Yep. Yeah. And that's the problem, is that whatever the reason, society, parents, your own thing, is maybe you didn't want to take this entry level job, but going to school and getting an education is good, but it's not necessarily the greatest path, especially if you aren't aligning it with your experience, because you get paid based on the value you deliver. And just because you have a master's or a PhD doesn't mean that you can deliver the value to the company that's going to earn you the money that's going to pay for the costs of all that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we can expand on that more for sure. I mean, I think it's very obvious when you see someone that is making $1 million a year, that is getting paid $1 million a year. Let's talk about a professional athlete. Let's talk about an actor on a TV show, whatever it is. You know, that person is an expense. They're not getting paid $1 million because they are somehow innately worth that. Rather, it has to do with the value they're adding back to the company, the sports team, the television show. You know, in the case of many of these people, because that person is there, the owner of that entity is then able to make multiples of that. It justifies the cost. If all you are is an expense with a degree, the employer doesn't care about that. The value needs to be behind it in order to justify the increase in income.
Right. And that's where you don't just get value from school. And sadly, I see this all the time. I saw this a ton in retail, that my best hires, and I've hired probably 1,000+ people over my time at Target. The best hires are people that worked in high school and college and had that experience, because, you know, college can give you some skills, but it doesn't teach you communication skills. It doesn't teach you on-the-job problem-solving skills. And in pretty much every single career, those are like the two things that separate the successful from the not successful, is can you communicate in a business environment or to customers or to your supervisors or peers? And can you problem solve? Are you always going and asking for help? If you have those two things, you will be super successful.
So Robert, you hired 1,000 people yourself. You're actually interviewing these people. What did you look
for? Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. Again, more actionable stuff. What did you look for in those interviews? I assume when you first started these interviews, the first couple hundred, you weren't able to discern how you could pick out communication skills and problem solving. I'm wondering if that changed as you got farther through, if you could pick out those people with slightly better precision. I don't imagine that it was anywhere near 100%, but just slightly better precision. And if so, what could you pass along to the audience to help them in a future job interview to show potential skills they have?
Totally. And you're right. It's never 100%. And that's okay, because at the same time, it's an interview. It's stressful. You know, people aren't always their best. So it's like, if you're close or I'm still a human. You're still trying to give people a shot, because like maybe you see something and maybe it's just a stressful environment. But at the same time, all I really cared about is, are you friendly? And are you nice? Can you look me in the eye? And can you just talk to me? That is really all it took in retail to get hired, because that is all I look for. I can teach you how to stock boxes, and I can teach you how to run items over a scanner and push the total button on the register. Everything you do in retail is so basic and so simple, but I can't teach you how to be friendly and how to be a nice person and how to engage in the polite way with the customers or your other coworkers. All I was ever looking for was interpersonal skills, because the job itself was so basic and easy that literally, and everyone kind of knows this, like, robots are taking over a lot of it, but robots don't have interpersonal skills and communication skills. And that's where people come into the equation.
So Robert, this is going to be the episode that keeps on giving, because we have spent the first 25 some minutes talking about this retail path to FI essentially, which is completely viable as part of that 10 to 15 year journey. I absolutely love that. And it's actually an incredibly high cap on what you could actually end up making, which is just awesome. But what you set up for yourself and what we have not explored at all is the fact that the kid that started off selling candy bars and had this kind of stable job and the stable path was willing to try something new. And you started a blog, and it's one of the biggest blogs in personal finance serving the millennial community that is out there. And when you started, you knew nothing about blogging. You didn't get a computer science degree. What's more than that, in my mind, what becomes really, really obvious is that you are easily funding your lifestyle through this blog at this point. So essentially, you have hit FI in multiple ways and multiple times over, which is just crazy. So let's talk about this. What inspired the college investor? Go back to day one.
Yeah. So it's funny you say I didn't get a computer science degree. Well, I actually thought I was going to get a computer science degree. And when I started at UCSD, I was a computer science major, but I hated being in the basement programming. Like, that was my freshman year of college, was doing these computer science classes in a basement, trying to program code. And I loved the science and I loved the math and I loved the logic behind it, but I hated the lifestyle of programming. And so that's when I jumped into poli-sci and I finished out my time at UCSD as a poli-sci major. But while I was finishing in my last year of college, you know, I was also that guy in the back row of my college class with my laptop open, and I was browsing the internet and I wasn't totally paying attention. I was reading a lot. I'd read like Yahoo Finance and I'd read other blogs, and I saw like that people were just like talking about their own experiences with money and finances and investing. And I was like, this is so cool. And being that I still love tech and I'm very passionate about that, I was like, I wonder if I could start something like this and kind of share my own random thoughts with the world. And one weekend, I was Facebook stalking people, and I found that one person that I used to know was launching their own blog and had like a Bluehost affiliate link kind of thing. And I clicked it and I started my own website, and the rest is kind of history there.
Well, it would be history on most shows, but on this show, we want to go at the granular level and kind of dive through this. So
yeah, let's do it.
If you look back at those first articles that you wrote, how would you grade yourself?
Oh, F. I think I deleted almost all of them at this point in time, or I have modified them up so you could never realize it, but they were terrible. It was like 100 words. Scottrade was like the broker of choice back then. It was like, why I think Scottrade is the best place to invest. And it was like 100 words about it. And then that was it. And it was like a link. And of course, no one clicked it. No one found it. Like, I made no money on it, but I started, right? And I just started putting out content out there.
All right. So Robert, you're writing these 100-word articles on Scottrade and they're not lighting the world on fire, obviously, but you stick with it. There's always that inflection point in a blog's history of, hey, I got my first mention on, I don't know, Yahoo Finance or something, or the New York Times, or even something small, my local San Diego newspaper, right? Talk us through that point. When did you realize like, hey, I've got something here?
Honestly, it took a long time. I had no idea what I was doing. I was just looking through the history here, and it took me about 2 years of blogging, maybe like 19, 20 months of blogging before I made any money on my site. And that's a lot of time. In my first month of making money, I made $25 on my site. But the first article that really kind of gained traction was, I thought I was going to, this is the college investor, right? I was going to talk about investing in money, but I started having problems with my own student loan servicer. And I was kind of like the typical millennial story here, where like my loan servicer didn't credit my payment the right way. And suddenly, like it said, my loan was like delinquent and it wasn't, it was their mistake. And I wrote about my battle with my loan servicer as a blog post. And that was like the first blog post where I started getting comments and people were like, oh my God, me too, or that's terrible. And I was like, wow, there's actually, I don't even think I had Google Analytics or any kind of tracking on the site at this time, but I knew people were leaving comments. And I thought that was the coolest thing, that there's people that I've never met before that are responding to an article that I wrote and sharing their thoughts and their own personal stories around it. And that was very motivating at the time.
I actually do remember our first comment on my blog. I'm pretty sure it was all I talked about to my wife for the rest of the day.
Right?
This could happen again. And then there could be two people that comment.
Someone out there is listening.
Yep.
So I guess my question, it sounds like you said in there, you named it the college investor because you thought you were actually going to talk about the nuts and bolts of investing.
Absolutely.
Was that the inflection point when you had that one article that got some traction? Is that when you said, hey, maybe this should be about student loans and millennials and college? And was that the point where you said, all right, maybe there's time for a change here?
Yeah, I just started becoming much more comfortable writing about other topics. Like I really had this idea that if you're going to be the college investor, you're going to write about investing and that's it, and I siloed myself in. But, you know, I started just kind of realizing that there's more to this personal finance experience. It could be a holistic thing. And I also heard in real life friends were like, you know, I really love the idea of investing, but all this student loan debt and other stuff is holding me back from it. So I could kind of see how it could naturally connect in terms of like, can we get you out of student loan debt or like free up some money in your student loan budget so that you could start investing and building wealth? And what are the connections in between all that? That's really kind of how it evolved over the next few years.
So it's like an order of operations in essence. You can't move on to investing until you've gotten rid of this anvil hanging around your neck, I guess.
Or at least you got to have that balance. Can you get out of student loan debt and start investing? Because my premise here is, you know, and you guys know this, the earlier you can start investing, the better. So can we start investing in college, even though you're dealing with student loan debt and maybe you're not earning a lot? And what are some tactics that you can do to maybe add more money to your budget every month so that you can tackle your loans and invest? And that's a lot of what we talk about with earning more money and side hustling. And it's very much my own story as well.
Robert, let me just go ahead and spoil this entire story. I know for a fact that in the month of February this past year, you got 2.4 million unique visitors came to your site to check out your content. That's an insane amount of exposure. That's an insane amount number of people that are benefiting directly from the content that you've been putting together over the last 8 years. And it's amazing. But I want to go back to go from, you got your first comment, you made your first $25 of income from this site. What do these points in traffic actually look like? Was this a viral moment that you got picked up because someone mentioned your site in a TED Talk that got picked up by the New York Times and it just went viral and spread across the world? How do you get to 2.4 million unique visitors in a month?
You know, I definitely had some pickups over time, but nothing crazy, nothing that's driven me millions and millions of people, no TED Talks, none of that. I really just attribute it to time, great content, and then a bunch of base hits. You know, I've been picked up in the New York Times and Money Magazine and Entrepreneur and Washington Post and all these places, but they were like footnotes. I never had like a full feature story about me or the site or anything. Like it's just mentions and things like that. It's really just been a bunch of base hits over 8-9 years at this point in time.
You have given me permission. So that's the only reason I'm going to drill down on this even farther. But I'm just thinking about this individual that maybe because they were on your site or our site or someone kind of in this area, they decided to start their blog and they got five visits to their blog last month. And they're trying to visualize, what does it look like to get to 2.4 million? And how do I even have any sort of metric to, you know, figure out what my next step should be? If you were to look back through your numbers, and I know on day one, you didn't have Google Analytics, but if you can look back at all, can you think through those points in time at which you, how long did it take you to get 1,000 visits a month? At what point were you getting 100,000 visitors per month? Help us get a sense, a feel for, was this just a straight linear growth, or were there months and years where you had doubled and tripled your audience?
It's been like year over year kind of doubling, but definitely nothing like month over month. if we go back, you know, we go back into 2014, 15, I would probably had about 100,000 visitors a month. And then when I started, I mean, like even for the first couple of years, I was only getting 100 visitors a day, you know, 200 visitors a day. It just continued to grow and build. And that's what I mean about base hits is it never was anything amazing. It was just, I consistent. And this is what I would tell anyone starting out is consistency. So, I mean, I would publish content anywhere from 3 days to 5 days a week. You need to promote that content. You need to connect with other people, not just sharing on social media, but can you connect with other people in the financial community that might be interested in your content? And then you need to have the best content, because if you are not creating the quote unquote best content, no one's going to give you a second thought. And the best might be long. It might mean including video. It might be including audio. It might be making charts and pictures, but it needs to be really solid content. And I only was writing 100 word posts that really were terrible content at first. And so it really just was a natural evolution that as I was creating more, I was getting better, I was writing longer, I was including more things, and I learned, I started networking with other bloggers, and you know, it just kind of built over time.
Robert, when we had Michelle from Making Sense of Sense on, she mentioned consistency as mm-hmm. one of her big takeaways. And it's interesting to hear you say that. And I'd love it if you could just dive a little more into that. Like, how much do you think that really matters? It's interesting to see two bloggers who get millions of visitors mention the exact same takeaway.
So it is 100% one of the most important things. So if, like I said, if I was to tell anyone starting out today that wants to start a blog, is consistency is key. And it's consistency with enough content to matter. So you need to write 2 to 3 times per week. And it doesn't have to be writing anymore. You could video, you could podcast, you could any kind of medium you want, but it needs to be 2 to 3 times a week. And you need to give yourself at least a year of doing this, because that gives you two different things when you do that. Is one, it shows your audience that there's going to be new content coming out. And so they'll have an incentive to check back in. And if your content is good and it's the best of it, they'll enjoy checking back in. And then number two, you personally get better at content creation. You can prove to yourself that you can do this, and it will really basically springboard you into the future, because you know you've done it for a year. Like, it's no problem to continue doing this. You've built the habits, you've built the routine.
Robert, I really appreciate you being willing to share these numbers at these different points in time. I think it's very encouraging for people just to kind of get a feel for what this path actually looks like. It could probably be very discouraging for someone that is starting on day one to hear about someone getting 2.4 million visitors a month. That's just amazing. But, you know, kind of visualizing it as a progression based on the hard work and investment. I mean, you've been investing your time in this for almost a decade now. It's truly incredible. Is there anything else that you could pull out of this and give to our audience that's listening, that's looking for these kind of actionable details? What else moved the needle for you?
Yeah, I think the other big aspect that really moved the needle for me was networking and connecting with other bloggers and personal finance people in this space. And it started out online, like I would network with other bloggers, I'd leave comments and connect on social, which kind of evolved into more conversations and maybe email. And, you know, there's some cool resources today, like the Rockstar Finance forums and, you know, different like the FinCon Facebook group where people post questions and get answers and stuff. And that was one really big point. But then the one that really changed my business aspect of blogging was going to FinCon. My first FinCon was 2013. So I'd already been blogging for almost 4 years at my first FinCon. Going to FinCon, it almost doubled my revenue into the next year, because it was that much of a game changer in terms of learning, connecting with people in real life, having those face-to-face interactions that solidified partnerships, and then also just my education. I started learning much more about what to do and how to do it the right way, and, you know, built real relationships that many of those have continued well into this day.
Robert, you're certainly echoing almost exact words that I've used to describe FinCon to this audience and certainly to my wife, Laura. It's kind of hard for me to quantify exactly, oh, I went to FinCon 2014 and got this out of it. But I do know specifically that my business and my network is dramatically larger than it would be had I not gone there. You just cannot replace face-to-face meetings. It just matters so much. And I would say, especially in this time of such a connected world where we are not face to face, it just matters to sit down and chat with someone. And yeah, those kind of connections are really valuable. And obviously this extends way beyond just FinCon, because we're talking about an audience here that might not be in the personal finance blogging world, but there are many of these conferences and meetups and meetings that people can attend and just go there, provide value, be a nice, normal person, almost like how you were describing when you were interviewing people. What are you looking for? You're looking for a nice, normal person to have a conversation with.
Exactly. And I think that's huge. It doesn't matter what your industry is, what you're working on, what your hobbies are. There's something really beneficial about just connecting with others that share your same ideas, share your same passions. Being a blogger, and you guys probably know this, no one gets you that isn't a blogger or a podcaster. They don't understand anything. So just going to other, being around other people that get you is so awesome.
Yeah, I totally hear you, man. So, Robert, we've talked about your backstory and your path through the retail world to actually making this incredible income there. And we've explored at a granular level, starting a blog on day one, making your first $25. Let's play that out. I think you prefaced beginning this episode by saying that you just recently left your job. What drove that? Where are you now in the present? What were the series of events that got you to now?
The cool thing is that, you know, the blog continued to grow and grow and grow. And so in about 2015, I was making more from my side income of the blog than I was at my day job. And even though my day job was doing really great, I had this other thing that was doing awesome as well in my spare time. You start to have this inkling that, oh, well, maybe like I could leave my day job and just do this full time. But, you know, I loved working at Target. And if you go and find some old podcasts and interviews I've done, I know specifically I said, I have no intention of ever leaving my day job. Like, this is great. Having two incomes that I can balance, I could save and fund a lifestyle that I want to do. And it was really just an exciting time for myself and my family.
And Robert, you've talked about not looking at life through the frugality lens. That strikes me when you're talking about larger income, side hustle. And talk us through how you approach your own personal finance, if you don't mind.
Yeah, totally. So I don't consider myself a frugal person. I don't consider myself an excessive person, though. I'm not flying private jets or, you know, doing crazy things like that, but I don't sweat the details. And, you know, we go out to eat a lot. We don't really mind our grocery and our food bills. And, you know, but it also is your priorities and what matters to you. And so I enjoy eating out and I enjoy those things. But I really am about earning more. It's all math. And you guys know the math here is, you know, you have your income and then you have your expenses and then you have what's left over. A lot of people focus on the expense side and cutting that. And that's great. And there's a point, though, that you can't cut anymore. You're still going to have some type of housing expense. You're still going to have some type of transportation expense. You're still going to have food expenses and other life expenses. You're never going to be able to get that number down to zero. You can get it very low, but it's probably not going to be zero. But that income side is kind of cool to me, because the income side is kind of limitless. There's not really an upper cap on how much you can earn. Now, there might be time constraints and family constraints and definitely other constraints on it. But in terms of the number itself, it's not really constrained. And so I've always really just tried to focus on that earning more side of the equation. If I wanted something, like I told you in middle school, I wanted to rent a game at Blockbuster. So I went out and sold candy bars so that I could do that. Everything else that I've kind of revolved around my life, I want to do something. I really just like what's the goal of earning slash savings that I need to get there?
I think that's a compelling case. I think that your own kind of lifestyle choices indicate that while you may not embrace frugality, you do at some point realize the value of your time. Because if it were truly just earning more money, you could have essentially had double the income by staying at Target and, you know, keeping the side hustle going on the side. And you walked away from a six-figure plus safe, quote unquote, job to take on a blog, which maybe could disappear tomorrow, right? I mean, that's got to be kind of your thought process as you're thinking about leaving that job.
Oh, and that was exactly the thought process. So like I said, if you go back to 2015, the blog was earning more. We were saving all this stuff. I mean, honestly, I think my savings rate through the last like 3-4 years was close to 50 to 75% because of that extra income. Because we also, like I said, I'm not frugal, but we're not excessive. We don't spend a ton. Pretty average middle class lifestyle here. The real driver was time and spending time with my family. So I have a 4-year-old son and an 18-month-old daughter. And the big drawback of retail is nights and weekends and the holiday season. As my blog really was earning multiples more than I was making at my day job, it was kind of like, why am I still doing this when it's not necessarily adding any incremental value to our family, but really it's becoming a detractor when I can't spend Christmas Eve with my family potentially, or, you know, Black Friday, which is now Thursday, Thanksgiving, I'm having to go to work at noon on Thanksgiving because you got to get ready for the Black Friday sale, right?
I love that you just said your blog is making multiples of your day job. So you basically broke the income game blogging.
Yes. I guess you could say that. So, but I still love Target. So it's kind of those things. It's like you said, Target was safe. Target provided health insurance. These things that when you're a self-employed business owner, you suddenly have to think about, it becomes scary, even though it really isn't when you actually do it. But when you don't do it and you've been comfortable for, you know, whatever, 13, 15 years, it's a scary thought. And then my wife and I had those conversations like, what if the internet shuts down tomorrow? like it would ever actually happen, but what happens? Are we going to be financially secure? Like, do we have enough money in our savings and, you know, accounts that we'd be able to provide for our family? And so the cool thing was we got there. Literally, if the internet shut down tomorrow, we'd be fine. We just was like, I can't go through another holiday season. And that's when I left Target last year. And it was really about like, you know, Paula Pant says this a lot, is show me your time and show me your money, and I'll tell you what you value. And I really believe that, but was I living it? And I don't necessarily think I was living it until I really left my day job and was spending my time and money with my family as much of the time as I could.
Wow, that is absolutely brilliant and really, really profound. I hope everyone goes back and listens to that again, because yeah, that's really, really important. So just to put a bow on this, you essentially did hit FI, right? Because if the internet went away tomorrow, you're saying you would be fine. So you actually, even though you had a website that is bringing in multiples of your fairly lucrative Target job, you still waited until you reached that point where if the internet broke, you'd be fine.
Yeah. And that's it. I mean, like, we're technically FI, but we're not living off of our assets or anything like that. So I can't share to what that feeling would actually be, which would probably also be an extremely scary feeling, as in, you know, I know some of your guests have talked about this, is converting your actual savings and retirement accounts into an income stream would be very scary, especially at this young age. But there's enough money theoretically there that it should work out mathematically.
Robert, this has been an incredibly actionable episode. This story it's fascinating and it's inspirational. It's a little bit aspirational, but at the same time, I can see the threads. I can see the choices that you made. There's nothing that you did that anyone listening to this, they couldn't find that it's off limits to them because they didn't go to Harvard or Stanford or Yale. They can't get accepted to that first job. And that's really what set you up for this. I mean, this is a middle class path to FI. Everything that you did, someone could follow in your footsteps. And obviously you can't guarantee results, but it's not off limits. There's nobody there. The gatekeeper is basically the individual saying, I'm willing to try this. And to me, I love that at a very personal level. And I hope that our audience gets value from this episode and is inspired by it just like I am. On most shows, that would be the end of the episode. But on this show, Robert, we would love to give you the chance to tackle the hot seat. Are you ready for this?
All right, let's do it.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right, Robert, question number one, your favorite blog that's not your own.
So I really enjoy reading Financial Samurai. It's just super in-depth content. And Sam at Financial Samurai really always has interesting insights on things that you necessarily wouldn't expect him to have insights on. So I love it. I read it all the time.
Oh, you got to give me an example of something that you wouldn't expect them to have insight on. That's too juicy.
Okay. I mean, honestly, so he had a baby in the last year. And so he's been blogging now probably as long as I have, 9, 10 years. But he's been writing a lot about parenting and how things impact you. He had an article the other day about the ideal size house and a layout to raise a family. He put like blueprints of houses that I don't know if he drew them up or found them. honestly, his insights is just really like relatable and interesting. And given like the whole context of his blog of, you know, higher net worth and investing, I mean, it is just fascinating. I love it because it's not expected. It's not topics that you've necessarily seen a lot.
Yeah, I actually am a big fan of his content. He's had a couple articles that's really stood out to me. And I love that he can be a little bit contrarian. Like what you think he's going to say is not actually what he comes up with. And he's not, and clearly the way he's writing some of these articles, he is not afraid of negative feedback, but I think we all get better because of the conversation.
No, it's so interesting. And like you said, his viewpoints, I really love how, you know, it's got actionable stuff, but he really intertwines with his own view to tell a good story, which I think is for some of the topics he tackles is very rare to do.
Well, let's go ahead and hop into question number two, your favorite article of all time. Now, this can be one that you wrote or somebody else's.
Yeah, I had a hard time thinking about this one, but the most recent one that stands out to me is the one I wrote, is the How Honest Financial Advisors Should Disclose Their Fees. Why this one stands out to me as one of my favorites is because it was a reader story and he shared some of his portfolio with me. And I've shared this a couple of times with the ChooseFi Facebook group, and he was just getting screwed by his financial advisor. He was paying something like $11,000 a year in annual fees on a $200,000 portfolio, which was just ridiculous. And his financial advisor was churning his portfolio every year. They'd bounce him back and forth between American funds and Hartford funds, just ran this poor dude on commissions and sales loads. And all of his funds had 1% expense ratios. What I broke down in the article is how you could set up a low-cost portfolio. I didn't judge his portfolio and the layout. I assumed it was correct, but basically taking these American funds and these Hartford funds, putting them into like similar or identical Vanguard funds, I was able to show how you could bring a portfolio that was costing you $11,000 a year in sales loads and expenses down to $176 a year in annual fees. So beyond the fact that it really, really, really angered me, I feel like I was able to paint a clear picture on, you know, 99% reduction in portfolio costs, which is crazy.
That's unbelievable. Yeah, I'm with you on the anger. I mean, that should be a crime. That is theft. I mean,
it should be. So here's the ironic part is this guy told me when he was sharing his story, he's like, my advisor says that he is the number one, you know, financial advisor in, I want to say like North Carolina or something. Well, who's measuring that? And he's like, well, his company. And I was like, well, you know what number one at his company means? It means that he earned the most money last year. So he earned that money off of you, buddy.
Wow.
Yeah, I believe he's number one. That's amazing. Wow. I mean, 5.5% on this poor guy's 200K portfolio. That is crazy. Wow.
Yeah, because he was getting hit at the front end sales load every year because the guy was churning them from Hartford to American funds and then back again and then back again. It's just ridiculous.
My advisor consistently talks about how he's the top performer in North Carolina. Well, what do you think that means?
Right?
That is crazy. All right. Hey, Robert, question number three, your favorite life hack.
I wrote about this on my site, but I actually sold my car 2 years ago. This is before I even left Target. And I Uber and Lyft, I mostly Uber as needed. So we have one family car. I just rideshare everywhere and it's so cost effective. It saves me so much money. It's so convenient and I love it. Unless like Uber or Lyft goes away, I don't necessarily see a need to own a car again for myself.
Oh, Brad, this sounds like your sibling right here.
This sounds like my dream life. That's amazing. Wow. So you're telling me you Ubered on your commute?
Yeah, I Ubered to work every single day. It worked out great. I broke it down in the blog post, but I think I was spending about $250 to $300 a month in Uber. But versus owning a car with like buying the car or financing it, however you want to do it, insurance, maintenance, registration, all that stuff. It really worked in my favor, even when I was going to work 5 days a week.
Did you have a regular guy or gal?
No, you know, surprisingly. So I Ubered, I think I have something like, you know, 700 trips. I've only had the same driver like 10 times. Oops.
Wow. At the level of volume you were using, you should have gotten concierge service.
I know, right?
All right. Question number four, your biggest financial mistake.
You know, I don't know if I necessarily have a ton of financial mistakes, but I'd say two come to mind. The first one is, you know, when I was 22 and I graduated college, I thought I deserved a brand new car. So I bought a brand new $33,000 car that ended up being $700 a month in car payments because I thought I was badass and graduated college and thought I was like a hot something 22-year-old that needed a new car. honestly, probably a total waste of money because now I don't even have a car and I Uber everywhere. But, you know, looking back, I should have just bought like a cheap used car if I needed a car.
I'm sure everybody was impressed with you and your car.
That's it. Like, who cares, right? But, you know, and the other thing that I would say that comes to mind is, luckily, I don't have a ton of financial mistakes, but when I was at the beginning of the college investor, like I also was all about investing, right? And I was like picking individual stocks, and I probably lost somewhere between like $5,000 and $7,000 over a few year period of time, thinking I was smarter than the market and trying to pick individual stocks that totally like backfired on me.
You know what? Call it market research, and it gave you tons of content to talk about on the college investor.
Totally. And it really helped evolve my lesson today, where it's like, go with low cost index funds. But the bigger challenge is find that asset allocation that works for your risk tolerance. I'm not a VTSAX guy 100%. I do like to have an asset allocation, but within that, low cost index funds.
Well, we can't all be purist.
No, we can't.
All right, Robert, question number 5, the advice you would give your younger self.
When it comes to money, I would say max out those IRAs and 401ks from day one. I remember when I was first eligible for my 401k at Target, Target matched my 401k 5%, dollar for dollar up to 5% of my pay. And everyone's like, well, just do your 5%. And I for probably 5, 6, 7 years, I thought that's all you were supposed to do is just take advantage of your company match. Man, I wish I would have put into the max. That would have been one thing that I really wish I could have done. It's gone. I think it's, you know, 18,500 this year, but back then it was still probably like 14,000, 15,000. It would have been really cool to have that maxed out from like day one. My life advice, if I could go back, is stop caring about so much of what other people think of how you're choosing to live your life. Kind of with that car, with blogging, and, you know, even leaving Target, I think a big gap in my leaving is like, what would other people think? And you, at some point in time, you have to stop caring. Like, you live your life, you do you, you be super proud of yourself, and you have to kind of brush off what other people think.
All right. Well, we do have a bonus question for you, and it's based on value. Now, for a lot of people, we talk about what you're not buying in the vein of frugality, but you aren't limited by those constraints, it sounds like. But I think it's still a very interesting question. Over the past 12 months, what purchase have you made that's brought the most value to your life?
So I will share with you, I don't buy a lot of stuff. We don't have things. We don't have a lot of, I keep it very simple. But the thing that I have bought, and it's actually more of an ongoing thing that I'll share, is we do all of our grocery shopping on Amazon Fresh, which is like Amazon Prime Now, I guess. They just changed it over. But for the value I get from a time perspective in doing my grocery shopping online, it is so huge. Because imagine this, right? I have 2 kids, one's 4, one's 18 months. The fact that I would have to load them into the car, go to the grocery store, unload them, put them in a shopping cart, do my shopping, cross your fingers there's no breakdowns or like yelling about like, I want this or I want that, get them back in the car, come home, unload everything. Same thing. You're praying for no meltdowns this whole time. I could pull out my smartphone. I could do my grocery shopping and I can have it on my doorstep within 2 hours. It has been game changing for me.
Wow, that is amazing. So you're telling me 100% of your grocery shopping is done through Amazon Fresh or Prime Now?
Yeah, 90%. I mean, we still hit up Target and buy some groceries when we're there and stuff, but it has eliminated probably 90% of our grocery shopping trips.
Plus, Uber doesn't come with car seats.
That's right. You can load it in. You know, I would say the part two of that is we also do Uber Eats a lot. I actually wrote a blog post this week about why I love Uber Eats. We've ordered it 43 times this year so far, because part two of that is it's so handy.
Hey, this has been so much fun, Robert. And I know there's a lot of people that are going to have questions both around your specific story, but also just as someone that has really crushed the game from a blogging perspective, I'm sure they're going to want to reach out to you. What's the best way for someone to contact you?
Yeah, you could head over to our site. It's thecollegeinvestor.com. If you love listening to audio and love listening to podcasts, we convert a lot of our episodes into audio now. So you can check out the College Investor audio show and you can find us there. I'm also on social, whatever your preference is, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Reddit. You can find the College Investor on all those platforms.
Robert, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Definitely. This was a blast, guys. Thanks for having me.
You know, Brad, in this episode, I love that Robert just absolutely is not claiming the frugal mantle. Like, that is not the place he's landing. And honestly, that's a little bit different than a lot of our guests. A lot of our guests, like me and you, have that natural bias towards frugality. We realize what a powerful tool that is. But one of the points that Robert made, and it's incredibly powerful, is that we're all subject to the same equation. And basically what he's talking about is the levers that we all have available to us. And he is focusing on the income strategy. I have no problem with that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And that was an interesting look, without a doubt. It's the equation is the exact same. What really matters is your savings. We all like to talk about savings rate because I think, A, it's a fun gamification aspect of it, right? But also we talk about lowering our expenses, but savings is what ultimately matters. So you could have your total expenses be $200K a year, but if you make $300,000 a year, you're still saving $100,000 a year. That's not nothing. Sure, your savings rate might be a paltry, and I say that tongue in cheek, 33%, but still you're saving $100,000 a year. So obviously, as you said, Robert has kind of broken the income game here. So I imagine both his savings rate and his savings amount are pretty significant. But anyway, what an interesting, interesting story and great conversation with Robert. I just enjoyed on a personal level having him on the show. It was just a fun conversation. And man, does his story just run the full gamut there.
The FI tent just got a little bigger. If you enjoyed this episode, if you've been enjoying the episodes up to this point, just take 1 second, press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on. Just lets the providers know you're getting value from the show and you want to be here when we produce additional episodes. If you want to support us and what we're doing here at Choose FI, here are 4 easy ways. 1, leave us an iTunes review. If you want to do that, just go to chooseify.com/iTunes. 2, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to chooseify.com/cards and get started today. 3, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free and just go to choosefi.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in cat. And 4, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 38, The Why of FI, and right behind that, have them go listen to episode 21, The Pillars of FI. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth one life hack at a time.